What's happening in the canine industry? For all the latest news, views, and expert opinions, stay right here for the Canine Paradigm. You'll hear from industry leaders, experts, doyens of the industry, learned colleagues, movers and shakers, and the odd randy guest. Get the latest insights and expert advice from both here and abroad from the people in the know. Now, here are your hosts, Glenn Cook and Pat Stewart. And I'm Lofty Fulton, and I'm out of here.
It's been so long since we've put a new...
We're shithouse at it. We're so bad at it.
It's, our poor sponsors.
We're so bad at it, and we want to get better going forward.
Yes.
But here's a quick ad, and then we're going to be better at this.
Okay.
We're going to be better.
Yeah.
I promise we're going to be better.
Yeah, except for the bullfed.
Yeah, fucking Einzelwiener.
Tell us about Einzelwiener.
He's been in it from the start. If you want a tug, a ball, a slip leash.
A slip lead.
You know, really, no joke, his slip leads are the best slip leads.
They are great slip leads.
They are the best.
But they're handmade. They're hand-loved.
Yeah.
Do you know, there's times where I look at material when we're actually buying things for our businesses, and some of them are just shit house.
Yeah.
Like, they're so mass-produced. Jason takes his time. He puts them together properly.
Like, if you're listening, chances are you're in the industry, you're in the business, you need a lot of leashes, you sell them to clients, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
Deck out your staff. The best thing about the Einzelwiener leashes is that he custom makes them.
He does.
You can get whatever you want, whatever color, whatever length.
Too. Like, he's approachable.
Want a handle on it, no handle on it, whatever. I had him make that handler pack for me because I got sick of people turning out with shit leashes. Now everyone I train with uses all these perfect leashes.
Yep.
So get some stuff from the Einzelwiener. He's been supporting us from the start. We love him. We hate him sometimes.
Make sure you're telling me he's a bullfed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Canineceuticals.
Going great. Thank you, people in the United States, who prioritize your dog's health through supplementation.
I am a walking testimonial for Canineceuticals because if you go back, you hear 18 months ago, I was like, yeah, pretty sure my dog's going to die any minute because he was so unwell, and got him on the sups, and he's actually in the best shape he's been in ages.
Narelle's always maintained if it never worked, she'd burn it to the ground. She's just got too much pride and too much neuroticism not to put something to market that she didn't believe in. And the wonderful thing about it is it's working well. The testimonials have been amazing and very heartfelt. Like, she gets people who are so agitated and depressed and distressed about the health and the well-being of their dogs. Narelle makes no outrageous claims. Mm-hmm. She's never said that it's the one thing that does everything for dogs. She just says it's going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
By law, she's not allowed to make those claims, but she wouldn't want to anyway. But what she does tell people is it's definitely going to do better for your dog.
Yeah.
We watch our own dogs. Opie, who's got more things than you could poke a stick wrong with him, he probably wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't through Narelle's treatment, through good supplementation, changing diets, all those sort of things. I could talk about it forever. I don't want to make this sound like a buy sales pitch. I'm a fan of it because I know if it works. If it didn't, I wouldn't.
Well, it's an ad.
Well, it's an ad.
But I wouldn't disgrace myself by talking about something that didn't work. I'd be the same with her. I'd just say burn it to the ground. I don't want to know about it.
Yeah.
And if you're a first-time customer in Australia or the US, Narelle's offering a 10% discount off the entire range of Canineceuticals products by typing in the discount code TCP10 at checkout.
Let's work through our sponsor list.
Yes.
These are the people that sponsor us and we love them for it and we're plugging their business.
Yes.
First on our list here is Daniel, who we don't know how to say is Tropiano? Tropino.
I thought we just called him Troppy Daniel.
Troppy Daniel. Dog Club, South Australia.
Yep.
Awesome training facility.
Representing South Australia. It is great to see that a state that's usually sleepy and not considered.
Just hosting some cool events there.
Yeah. Yeah, good on you, Daniel. Well done.
George Kittredge.
Rowdy Hound.
Yeah. It's fucking cool. It's a box for your dog that goes on your motorbike.
The only one that I know of.
Yeah. It's the coolest product
ever. Not in Australia yet. So hopefully one day we can talk to Horny George about getting some Rowdy Hound dog boxes in here. He does training videos. He shows people how to train their dogs to get into the Rowdy Hound. He's a dog trainer himself. He's in the biz.
Yep. Barbara DeGroote.
From the Heart Dog Training.
That's her.
Our sugar mama.
Yeah.
She's so good.
I love
her. She asks nothing in return. She's as placid with love and money. She's very encouraging all the time. Thank you, Barbara. She's a Roddy lady. So what would you expect?
Yep. Tailored Canines.
We don't know much about Tailored Canines. They just turned up one day and said, hey, we just want to throw some money at you. But they offer a complete range of canine training services.
Yep. Tailored Canines. Where are they? They're in Canada, right?
They're in Canada.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple of Canadians, we've got a couple of Americans, we've got a couple of Aussies. Good eclectic mix. We haven't got anyone from Europe. Fucking hell. Up your game.
But we can't take any more sponsors. So We're bad enough at Birdie O'Shea. Oh, yeah. So we are plugging as well. Birdie was on for us last week and then told us about her webinar thing that she's got going on for people in the
Magic of Dogs.
Magic of Dogs. So head to birdieoshetty.com, I think is her website, and you can check that out there. All the sponsors, trust us, we're getting better at the ads. I promise you, next, we're going to be in touch with you and we're going to get better at it. We're going to take it more seriously. We're just shit at it because we've got other stuff and this is just an extra that we like to do. We thank you very much
for your
support.
But we both spanked each other. Pat spanked me and then I spanked him. And
we need to get better at this.
Yeah, we do.
We were going to leave it another week of the existing ad and thought, no, we can't possibly. We're actually together for the first time. Yep. That's what's been holding us back is that
we haven't been together.
Yeah. I missed you.
I missed you too.
All right, that's it. Here's the show.
Bye.
Welcome back to the Canine Paradigm. I'm your host, Pat Stewart. I'm joined by my co-host, Glenn Cook.
It's the non-plague show.
Don't make me laugh or it'll come back. Okay. Hey, we've got questions to answer.
Yeah, we have.
We're a couple of days late on recording this because it was the apocalypse during the week of rain, so we couldn't get together.
That definitely happened.
Yeah. Should we just hook in?
Yes, we should.
All right. We put out into the Facebook discussion group, which if you're a listener and you're not in there, come on, guys, get in there. Unless you're not on Facebook anymore. I suppose that's a reasonable excuse. But we put a post in here saying that we're going to do an AMA, Ask Me Anything episode. Mm-hmm. Got lots of different questions and comments and discussions that unfurled under that. So as always with these things, it's the same what I do when I do the live streams is I only sort of take a somewhat cursory glance at the questions.
Yep.
Because I want the answers to be not prepared. I'd rather that be more conversational between us rather than a presentation. There is a couple of things that I saw. There are a couple of questions. And if we get to them today that I thought, oh, you know what? I will put some thought into a nice presentation on that.
Yep.
And maybe that'll be a future episode or a Patreon thing or something like that. So let's start now with Tristan Pearson. Says, not so much a question, but I'd love to hear about varying reward placement, delivery, and indirect versus direct reward. Benefits of the above and when to use each method. I love an Ask Me Anything episode. Cheers. What do you think?
I kind of feel like we've done entire episodes on each one of those questions.
Yeah, we have. Yeah. I think the main thing with reward placement and delivery is that you always use it to your advantage. I think that's one of the most important things that you can look at that through the lens of like, well, if you put your reward in a way that it's going to cause you conflict, if it's going to derail the dog from the position, there's a million ways to talk about it in the negative sense. Mm. But the best way to really think about this is to think about using reward delivery and placement in order to cultivate the behavior. So there's certain rules that you have to abide by. There's things of, creating stability via delivering rewards in position. There's creating flashy, more powerful, sort of faster behaviors by rewarding out of the position. And in the learning phase, you want to come up with a balance of those things. Balance is an interesting word, right? Because we often think when you imagine a set of scales, like the image that comes into my mind whenever I hear the word balance is a set of scales. But what's important to remember in those sets of scales is like the weights is not necessarily equal on both sides in order to create balance. That's what I think is really important. When people think balance, you think an equal amount to create balance on both sides. And it's like, no, it's unequal amounts in order to create balance because dogs will have preferences and they'll already come with biases and they'll come preloaded with certain thoughts and feelings about things.
History. And so, they have history.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. So creating a balance in the learning phase of like, if a dog is a slow and lazy dog, then more rewards out of position, right? And if a dog is a very fast and, those very highly strung dogs, then you want to be rewarding in position much more. You want to create a balance where the dog turns up with what it brings. And that is somewhat unchangeable. Like that's who the dog is. And that's on one side of the scale. And then it's up to you to decide, okay, well, because of this dog and who it is and the way it thinks and feels, I'll create balance on the other side of the scale. And that might look completely different to the way that you would do it with a different dog. I think in terms of reward, indirect versus direct rewards, I think that the truth is that for the most part, there's a few different definitions on that people use, but the way that I think about it is a direct reward is that anything that the dog is pursuing in order to get. So if you're luring, you're using a direct reward. Anything where the dog is The act of trying to get the reinforcer, the reward, brings on the behavior. That's a direct reward. The dog's looking at it. It's a direct reward. And an indirect reward is anything where the dog has to separate itself somewhat from the idea of getting it in order to perform a task that it knows will lead to it. And that then doesn't mean, it doesn't matter whether it's a food or a tug or, you know, whatever the actual thing is. It's more of its relationship to the behaviors that you're either asking the dog to do or teaching the dog to do. That's how we define an indirect or a direct reward. And the balance of those is that to have a dog that you can call trained, a dog that you know that you can ask to do something and it will, you have to get to the indirect reward. Like that's how you have to finish. If your dog, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a dog that you're going to go into competition with where you have to leave your reinforcers on the side of the field or in the car, or a dog that you're out walking with and when it goes full Fenton on you and chases deer and you're going to actually be able to recall it, you have to have got to the point where the dog will do the behavior without first being primed to see the reward and know this is what I'm working for. And so you have to get to an indirect reward. And so I think whatever system you end up in, whether that's shaping, whether that's luring, you know, whatever it is along the way, it doesn't really matter. So long as you have the end goal in mind of the dog has to be able to perform this behavior when I say to, with the single cue of me saying, do this, results in the dog doing that, for the possibility of a reinforcer, not necessarily the guarantee. And I think that's dog training in a nutshell.
That's a good point. I was thinking as you were talking along there that eventually with direct reinforcement, you're going to have to fade at some stage and you have to have that in your mind. The setup has to be, I'm in a teaching / learning phase of my dog's education. I'm primarily working with direct reinforcement at this point in time. I'm using continual schedule of reinforcement along the way. I need to start thinking about, because you've got a backward plan. You've got to begin with the end in mind. Like, how do I actually get rid of this? How do I get to the proofing phase? What's that look like as we start progressing along? And that's what I find that some people, they develop a little bit of a crutch along the way where they keep things with the direct reinforcement and then wonder why they're having a reliability issue with their dog when they try and start fading away, because then they make enormous gaps in their fading. They start making it like, today we're going to remove the ball, today we're going to remove the food, without actually setting the dog up and fading it out slowly, where the dog starts to understand, you know, like, this is how it works. Like, I don't get it immediately anymore. It's just the program. It's the way that we actually do things. It's very important in that process that we start thinking about the process, as I said before, beginning with the end in mind. I love that phrase from Anthony Robbins. Thanks, Tony. It's very much an important part of the program. Like, sure, I can begin with this, no problem, but I can't use it ongoing. Otherwise, I'm going to develop a dog that has reliability issues because it thinks there is no presentation of a reinforcer or a reward, I should say. So I'm not going to do the behavior because you haven't got the bribe in place. And that's the issue. Mm. We've talked about this in the past. We've talked about rewards versus bribes. If you continue along this, your reward becomes a bribe because you're basically saying to the dog, here's the toy, here's the food, come on, let's do the behavior because I've got the thing that you want. And then the dog goes, yeah, cool, I'll do it because I can see the payment's ready. Primarily, yeah. Think of a person that would come to you and say, you know, like you ask them to do something and I say, cash first. And you say, yeah, sure, no worries. And then you pay them. But even then, you know, that can lead to reliability issues as well. So I find that great to start with while you're on a continual schedule and you're in early phases of training. But then, yes, please, you've got to start thinking about fading it away so the dog starts to understand, I still need to do the behavior, but then develops a good anticipation of it as well, like thinking about the reward, not literally locking eyes on it, but thinking, okay, well, there is a possibility of it being here. And we develop the power of maybe, which is extremely powerful in controlling all types of behaviors, that maybe I will get it and maybe it will be better than I anticipated. Mm. If you can be a provider of that style of training and even that, well, that style of education, eventually your student is going to be better at the behavior and more powerful at it. But you still got to do all the preconditioning work that comes along the line with it anyway.
This weekend, I'm in Canberra teaching a one-day thing down there. It's called Below the Surface. And the start of it, talking about motivation. Mm. Got a handout I'm going to give everyone there, but it talks about attention, intention, and attraction. Mm. And I feel like when you're dealing with training dogs, especially sort of dogs that really want the thing, right? Like when you've built up a decent amount of drive, or when we're talking about using motivation, you want to build that motivation to the maximum that serves us. But then you've got sort of three measures. And this is still something I'm coming up with the proper definitions for that, but I feel like the dog's attention, like what it's actually paying, like what it's focused on, is really relevant to us, because we often, one of the buzzwords that we always use in dog training is this engagement thing. But that's what I think engagement has, like three portions to, like the attention, what's it actually looking at, its intention, what's it really trying to achieve, and its attraction, like what's it actually being drawn to. And I feel like a lot of the time when people are working on engagement, they've built a lot of attraction to the reinforcer, but not really any intention or attention from the dog. You know, like the dog is just like attracted to them. In the same way, if I'm out working with my dog and someone, you know, if we're in an off-leash area or whatever, and a person has a chuck-it stick, you know, and they're chucking a ball for their dog, they have my dog's attraction. Right? He's drawn to them like glue. And if I allow him to, he'll go flying in and he'll be right in their face and be waiting for them to throw it. Their own dog becomes invisible to him and he's so drawn to that, which obviously I don't allow him to do very much. Depends on the people and how well I know. But he has no intention towards them. It's 100% towards the ball. And he has no attention to them. They could say and do anything and he wouldn't listen. He wouldn't hear it. They're invisible beyond. They're just an arm attached to a chuck-it stick that's going to throw a ball. And if they ask him to do anything, he doesn't even hear it. He's like, they're invisible to them. And I feel like that's what I see quite a bit from people when we've told them to build heaps of motivation, you know, like when we're telling people to build heaps of drive and bring that engagement onto them, a lot of the time they just have built a lot of attraction to the thing that they're holding, which is fine. Like that's the starting point, but then you got to start separating the dog's intention and its attention. Like what's it actually focused on and what's its goal here? Sure, at the start, all those need to be the reward, but then eventually you've got to get like some intention towards the behavior, some attention towards the handler, and its attraction can still be towards the reinforcer. And I think that it's very difficult to get beyond the phase of the dog's attraction being away from the reinforcer. So that's why reward delivery and placement is so important. You know, paying dogs, building a mix of payment in and out of position, where you hold the reinforcer, the way that you deliver the reinforcer, if you're after really precise behaviors, all of that's going to be really important, because even though you've got your dog's attention, it's doing what you want it to do. It's doing as you say, it's listening for commands. Even if its intention is to do the work really well because it enjoys the process of doing it, it's still going to have a level of draw towards the reinforcer. Dogs are pretty much always going to drift towards reinforcement delivery and placement. And that's a, you know, that's true whether you're going for really high-end competition behaviors or whether you're just teaching your dog to walk nicely on the leash in front of you. If you're continually rewarding across the body, you're going to end up with a dog that crabs across your body. Like it's just a foundational law of dog training that they're always going to have a level of draw or attraction to the reinforcer.
In addition to that, I would say that the dog has to be aware of consequence as well, which is along the way, it's part of the journey. It's, you know, as you get into the middle phases of training, when you're actually starting to talk about training with a dog, is it needs to be aware of consequences to not do those behaviors as well. So that's one of the, I had a Zoom call with a client the other day and we were very much talking about that as when to introduce consequences, how they work and what they actually mean, because everything else is great. We certainly want the dog to develop all the power, understanding of the behavior, to become conditioned in the behavior, to develop that nice consistency, have a nice spicy attitude towards the behavior, but then also understand I've got feelings, big feels about wanting to do all these other things like running over to that thing or chasing person X's ball and so forth. But then they have to understand, but if I do that, if I do it, this is a consequence of that happening. So I'm better off at remaining here where there's reliability. I won't endure that. And I also will develop this along the way. So they understand that my relationship is better with you. At least I've got access to a good reinforcer. It's going to be good enough for what I want anyway, providing you're a smart and intelligent handler/trainer and you'd condition the behavior well with the dog, but you've also used a good selection of reinforcers with the dog as well.
Agreed. All right, should we carry on?
Before we do, what was the first question, the first part of that?
I'd love to hear about varying reward placement and delivery and indirect versus direct reward, benefits of the above and when to use each method.
When you started answering that first part of the question, I want to tip back into that because I recall a conversation that you had with Helmut Reiser when you went to his seminar in Melbourne. And he was talking about let's say, for example, a dog had possession of a tug or a wedge or something like that. The dog has dropped it and you bend down to pick it up. And he was talking about only move at the level that the dog is capable of, not over arousing the dog to spoil the behavior again.
Yeah.
I remember early in my training that, you know, we used to practice that quite a lot. You never really think about it too much. Sometimes when you just develop an art in training, you just understand this is what I've got to do not to boil the dog over. But when you've actually got someone thinking about these procedures and practices and remembering how important that is to pass that on to your students or people that come to learn from you, all of this plays such a delicate art form, and they're missing links of information because these are things that we've done in the past before. You never really consider the power of slow movement, being deliberate in what you're doing, not to bring on over arousal or spoiling something that you're working very hard, and not to, let's say, for example, you're in a development session. You're trying to get good predatory work out of the dog. You want the dog to be steely glazed and locked on, but at the same time, you don't want to create over arousal. You don't want the dog out of its mind. You want the dog inside its mind. You want the dog very deliberate in its type of behavior. So I value that comment from Helmut. And I think that the fact that you brought it into a conversation, I thought those sort of things really need to be known by the public when we're doing deliberate behaviors with our dogs, or when we're using deliberate forms of reinforcement with our dog. You know, we need to be very aware of, it could be me that's making my dog lose its mind in the behaviors that we're trying to create.
For sure. I think it's one of the things that gets overlooked so much is that your body language cues to the dog
absolutely
become so important to the behaviors that will unfold before you. And so being precise in your movements so that the dog can find those commands, those triggers, those things, because it's important. Like, you know, at the end of the day, we always want to go for having things on a verbal command, but the dog, in order to get things there, for sure, there has to be some kind of trigger prior to that. So there is always going to be, whether it's the remnants of moving the lure or some sort of gestural thing that carries the weight to the dog of like, okay, do this, right? Like you're going to set something in motion via some sort of physical action. I really like to encourage people to, and I do it obviously myself, by taking control of that. Something I have a lot of, and I've got a bunch of footage of it. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it, but I've got a bunch of footage of me doing that with Kai, the bully, right? Where like in a down, I could put him in a down and have the ball sort of between me and him. So he's in the down, and the ball's on the floor, and then there's me, and I'm kind of stalking him a little bit, right? Like sort of indicating that I'm going to take the ball before he gets a chance to, like I'm going to run at it. And it takes a lot of practice because there's times where the moment I do that, he breaks a position, and then I have to, you know, like it's a form of punishment where I don't let him get to the ball, and I go from being very tense in my body and staring at him like with a lot of tension to then just completely neutral and loose, and I catch his leash before he gets to the ball and we do a little loop, and I like it's very clear to him like, no, you stopped that really fun thing that we were about to do, like we were about to race to get that ball. You just put an end to that by going before I said we could start, right? So he very quickly then goes, oh, well, I don't want that to happen, and starts holding the down. And then I start getting to the point where I can then give the marker out of that position and he flies into the ball. Or from that really slow, stalky position, it sort of really builds the dog up. He feels like he's in a stalk as well. You can see his entire body posture change. And then I'll ask for a sit from the down. And of course, the first time, like, because I've done 100 reps of him getting the ball, he doesn't even hear me say sit. He goes straight after the ball. And I have to restrict him and I help him come into the behavior. But now there's a lot of fun involved in that, right? So now when he's in those down positions, it's not just a case of me like, okay, well, I'm going to pick up the ball and hold it ready for the next rep. He's looking, going like, what's going to happen here? And it becomes a game of anticipation. And it means that he's now, whilst holding the down, even though he's not doing anything, mentally, he's very much doing something, right? Mm. So like his body is completely static. He's not moving at all, but mentally he's in a full anticipation and the excitement around which ones are going to be from this position where you've coiled this spring, you've built a lot of tension into this position. Are you going to launch me into the ball or are you going to ask for a behavior? And he's like cycling. And the thing is, this kind of thing can cause quite a bit of stress in a dog. Like, it's repetitive stress for the most part, but it's, you know, stress of anticipation of which way is it going to go. And of course, he makes the wrong decision now and again. And that's the importance of balanced training, because you can't do this kind of thing if the dog makes a wrong decision, because then you've got no way of giving him feedback, right? Mm. Like, you can't do this. You have to make sure it goes right. But every now and again, he goes for the ball and I catch him on the leash and I'm like, nah. And we do that reset again, right? So like, it's a form of punishment. Technically, it's punishment because I'm stopping him doing that. But if you were to observe it, there's no real pressure beyond catching him and making him do a loop and giving him a period of boredom in what was a really exciting time. And that sort of all doing that has really all built on what I learned Helmut explain about that, like staying below threshold. Well, I was like, okay, well, what if I start playing with that threshold, right? Like, what if I start pushing to the limit and trying to increase that threshold via that stalking him sort of action? And it's not for all dogs, but it's certainly with some dogs, and especially some of the spicier sort of dogs that I do it with, they love it. And then it turns out that now downing is not downing. Downing is stalking. And so when he's in that down, he's like super excited about what can come from here, because this is super boring. You know, like, there's other ways to give down different values like that. Like, I want the dog to think of it as a rest sometimes as well. Like, you know, I might exhaust a dog in a gameplay so that by the time that I ask it to down, it's like, oh, thank God. Like, this is like the down becomes reinforcing because it's a place to rest. But I also want, in the higher state of arousal, when the dog isn't tired, I want the down to be reinforcing because it puts the dog into a state of mind where it goes into anticipation of the stalk of what's going to come. But I have to then be mindful. This, you know, relates to reward delivery and placement. I have to then be mindful of my schedules of that so that he isn't on a hair trigger in the down, that he can hold it and not, you know, like that he truly finds the signal that is the release from the down rather than just anything that triggers him. He, you know, that he's simmering at a point where he's about to burst out of it.
And be so aware of the consequences as well. The dog must be aware like, if I blow this is the negative side of this not going right.
Yeah, that's right.
We talk about the build-up quite a lot. We talk about like the anticipation of what's going to go right. But this is very much where people start evading or avoiding the discussion of punishment. And the punishment, as you said before, can be very much about some strong form negative punishment where you demonstrate to the dog, you're lost to me. You and me aren't in this anymore. Or the dog gets put away, whatever it may be, whatever is most effective and has the highest level of impact on the dog. But that is very much a big part of the training journey of a dog and their handler or and their trainer, is they must be aware, sure, we're going to do all these amazing levels of arousal to bring on the behavior, to make you feel amazing in these behaviors, to make you feel like I understand this and I have a relationship with the behavior you're trying to build here. But they have to really have a strong connection with the consequence as well. I recall on this when I got challenged years ago. I know I've talked about this on the episode where I got challenged to bring my dog down to a park where some other trainers were accusing me of being a balanced trainer and using correction chains, blah, 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 blah. The one exercise I challenged them to, I said, since I'm here on your turf with your people, what I want to do is a 20-minute downstay. I'm going to have your dog next to my dog, 20-minute downstay, because I knew my dog was absolute king at this behavior. And it didn't matter what I did, his favorite toys, anything, it didn't matter. Anything, like he'd sit there and he'd quake, like you could see him shiver anticipation to get it, which is great. I knew he was thinking about this. He had presence to what was actually going on, but he would not move because he also knew and had a strong connection to the consequences of, if I fuck this up, I lose everything. I don't get the grand prize at the end of this journey. Whereas the other dog had no hope in this. With, you know, beautiful dog, it was more about the owner, not the dog. The owner of the dog was psychotic and had delusions of grandeur. The dog itself was a beautiful dog and had potential to be a very, very well-trained dog. Put the dog in a drop. As soon as I got a ball out and kicked it along the floor, the dog broke straight away. Its arousal level went through the roof. It couldn't contain itself. It didn't have any idea of consequences. It just took off after the ball. I know I've told this before. The owner lost her shit, tried to attack me. It was just crazy. And then
you said this before? I don't know if you've ever talked about someone attacking you.
Oh, yeah, she went crazy. She came over and started pushing her finger in my face and stuff like that. And I said, my dog is a protection trained dog. Like, if you assault me, that's a go ticket for him. And she goes, you brought a dangerous dog here. How dare you? And carried on like a pork chop. It was insane. I've told this story many, many times. Like, I think clearly on that, because she was saying to me, your dog's fearful to get up. Your dog is afraid of you. And I said, my dog understands the consequences. Sure, he understands. And I said, but afraid? You're missing the point. I released him from the position and told him he was allowed to go and get the ball, and he just ran over where her dog was and took the ball and ran back to me. And she said, that's it, you're cheating. And I said, oh my God, this is so indicative of somebody who completely misses the point about how an ultimate package and tying everything up and creating understanding and empowering the dog and giving the dog the mechanism of control to understand, like, if I do all these behaviors, it's going to be so amazing for me. Like, the outcome is going to be incredible, which it was. I mean, I was tossing the ball for him. He was having a great time. And I said, at no time has my dog lost any animation. At no time has my dog lost any of his spirit. I said, the whole time he's down there, he's believing in himself, like, this is only going to get better for me. My life is only going to improve here. I know. And you've talked about this before, like, when you talk about building hope and drive in the dog. Like, he knew it. He completely knew it. Like I said, one of the things I knew he was absolutely king on, and he was so fucking good at, even when he did his companion dog title and he was in the actual arena with all the dogs doing the drop stay next to him, another Rottweiler came up and stood over him and was trying to initiate a fight with him. And all he was doing was looking between the dog's legs at me, thinking, what do I do here? And I said to the judge, are you going to do anything about this before a fight starts? And he went over and excused the other dog from the trial. And my dog just looked at me and went, thanks, boss, in his own way. But the dog stood over him for a good 20 seconds before they excused the dog from the trial. And he held the position because he just knew, I know there's another dog here. I know this dog has intentions. This is Dutch. He was one of my early day Rottweilers. Dutch was no shrinking violet. He wasn't a dog aggressive dog, but put pressure on him and he will respond to it. But that's exactly what I didn't want him to do. He did exactly what I wanted him to do, because he knew if you break, this is going to cost you everything. So he went on, he got his title, you know, like, he did a great job. He was a really good dog with a good understanding of those sort of things, but only because I did all of that early developmental work with him where he completely understood how to control his arousal levels. It starts for everybody, you, me, and all of the people that we're talking to. It starts exactly the same way. It starts with ultimate difficulty. It starts with a lot of times that the dog breaks and attempts to break because the dog doesn't know any better. It doesn't have any control. Its arousal is controlling everything in its mind at that point in time. It doesn't know how good it can be until it experiences how bad it can be. And I say that sparingly and lovingly when I'm talking about training as well. I'm not talking about beatings and floggings, but I'm talking about missing out, losing, getting taken away, everything ending, the relationship between you and the dog, like the whole, like, waiting to do this great training session, but then it ends because the dog fucks up. Like, that slowly gets seeded into the behaviors of the dog, because then the dog starts to understand, I don't want this to end. Like, the more I play this game, the more I'm within the rules that you're creating, the more I can control what happens and the more length that I actually get in how long this game endures. I mean, dogs are fucking smart. They pick that up really quickly. They start learning, like, I can stretch this from a 2-minute game into a 25-minute game as long as I stay within the, you know, like teaching a child not to go over the lines when you color. You know, like, as long as I stay within the lines, I'm golden.
I think the best correlation is, we do this with kids all the time. You see kids do it with each other, is that there's fun in negative consequences when those consequences just result in, like, a timeout and a reset. So what you see is, like, kids do it to each other all the time. You'll be starting a race and they go, ready, steady, bananas. Kids do that dumb shit all the time. And if you take off on bananas, you go, oh, nah. It's not like they don't let you run the race, right? Like, you don't get to go. It's like, nah, you made a mistake. You got to come back. And that's all we're talking about when you're doing that kind of thing. It's like, oh, no, you don't get the ball. You're not getting the thing that you're going after. And there's a period of, like, all the tension leaves, all that anticipatory fun disappears from me and from you. And there's this awkward, like, nah, you have to come back. And if it's a kid, then they have to walk themselves back around. And if it's a dog, then you've got them on the leash and you're like, nah, and you just take them on a little loop. And maybe on that loop, you're disappointed with them and you tell them that. And if they're the kind of dog that takes feedback in that way, you might give them a couple little pops on the prong as you go around, like, hey, you did the wrong thing, to add some, like, some positive punishment to the negative event. But it's not like a injurious, you know, like, it's not like you imagine somebody, when you say that kind of stuff, people go, oh, and then he said helicopter the dog with the prong. Like, it's feedback. It's just like, ding, ding, like, hey, that was incorrect. You know that. This is how I convey that to you. And the dog's like, yeah, got it. Let me have another go. And then it's the same. You see kids do the same shit. We do the same with dog. You go, ready, steady, and you leave them there for too long. And then they break the position because like the kids on the starting block were leaning too far forward. And the dog was like, I've only got so much hold in me at this level of arousal. I didn't realize it could go for that long. So of course they break and you're like, oh, nah, nah. And you bring them back around. And so then they realize, oh, okay, well I need to simmer at a lower level, which I can hold for a longer duration of time. Mm. So the way to teach this sort of stuff is it's very fun. And when you see people or you hear of people that are like, oh no, that form of balance training is, you know, like all the dumb shit they hear, you're like, well, in what world? This is actually very fun for the dog. And like games and how you play them, they're only fun because you can lose. If you win all the time, if it goes your way all the time, if you're successful all the time, that's very boring. That's why, like, have you ever heard the story of Superman, the original, like when the comics came out with when Superman, the character was created? He was like the most popular comic book character for about 6 months. And then people just stopped buying it because they're like, this is fucking boring. This guy's indestructible. Mm. Like there's nothing that can defeat Superman.
Yeah, that's when they had to have kryptonite. They had to make up kryptonite.
Yeah. They had to make that shit up. Like, so for the first 6 months or whatever it was of Superman existing, he was unbeatable. And initially for a short period of time, that was made for some really cool stories. He's sweeping the streets, like he's fucking shit up. But then it's like, well, there's no challenges for this dude. He just fucking wins every time. Mm. Like nobody can get in his way. Nobody can stop him. He can't be beaten in any way, shape or form. Why would I read the comic book? I know where this is headed. This is bad guy does something bad. Superman fixes it. No problem. So they had to bring in a weakness. There had to be a way for him to experience challenge and difficulty. And there had to be some risk. Superman had to have some skin in the game for people to start being interested in it again. And that's exactly the way I think it works with a lot of the play-based stuff that we do with the dogs, or not just a play-based, but training in general, to have the dog really have buy-in into this. Because if it goes your way every single time and you can't do anything wrong, I know it's one of the questions that we're going to come up against soon, but I feel like people don't understand how much of a source of reactivity that can be when you just let a dog do whatever it wants to do at the moment it wants to do it. Because a lot of dogs are very fucking scatterbrained. And if you allow them just to keep reinforcing their scatterbrained nature, that just gives them way too many options that are on their mind all the time. And they're going to start bouncing around between those things, right? And that's going to be observable as reactivity by us, because it's a dog that barks at this and then sniffs that and then runs over here. And we're going to observe that dog and go, oh, like this is a reactive dog because it's just acting on impulse nonstop and it never settles into doing any one thing. And that is really easily caused by giving a dog too much success with too many options and no feedback as to not doing something, because mm-hmm. then it never learns to just settle in and do something, like, you know, ignore other things and just stay completely focused on the one thing that it's doing. It's a big bugbear of mine at the moment. And I'm putting together a presentation for something and I had to go back to a certain trainer. I had to go through 6 years of their content. It was torture to find a certain, but I'm not even going to say his name, but has a very strong accent. And he posted a video years ago that I've often referenced to people about. He had a very reactive dog and I could see how he had caused the reactivity. And he posted a video that he was claiming was great training. And I was like, wait, if you don't see how you're causing all these reactive issues in your dog, how are you traveling around teaching people about reactivity? This is textbook 101. And I had to go through 6 years of horrible content to find this one fucking video. You know, I got it now. So it's high on my mind.
Mm.
Shall we move on?
I was just going to say, we're going to do the whole episode on this one question.
Yeah, reward, leader, and passion. All right. Carrie Jo says, how do you like to teach and build functional toy play? How do you use toy play to create a work ethic in your dogs? Is it different for pet dogs versus working or sport dogs?
That's a good question. The answer really is they're strongly in parallel with each other, except the difference between a pet dog versus a working/sport dog is there is a migrational path between playing with something leading into biting other things such as tugs, wedges, soft sleeves, harder sleeves, suits, and so forth. I just feel that a lot of the times with working dogs, we're developing towards something. Like, we've got an end goal in mind. It doesn't mean that we don't use the ball as part of that cycle of reinforcement as well, is that we don't bring out favorite things that the dog likes. I was watching old video of you and me working in the shed in the early days when we were developing Randy and getting ready for his PSA title. And there's pictures of him in drop stays, you rattling around him and running around him with can curtains and so forth. At that stage, we decided that, or I decided that I wanted him to be a leg dog because I'd never taught a leg dog at all. All of my other dogs had been arm dogs. We were teaching him and targeting him onto the leg. You were holding the ball at the time, like you were holding his reward. He was also rewarded by biting you at the same time. But what we were trying to show is that he had a clear understanding of when he gets told to do the work, he'd bite you in the leg. Mm-hmm. Then when we would out him and told him he was finished and we would reward him, he would ignore the leg and grab the ball off you. So it was very clear to him. He wasn't muddled in the mind about how to control what was happening or what each sequence meant in that event. Getting back to normal pet dogs and so forth, I believe that, and we've had people like Jay on who's talked about this. I know Ivan introduces it as a big part of his cycle, and most of us agree when you look at it, play is an extremely important part of the relationship between you and the dog. I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I just want to touch on this with a dog that came to see me during the week, and it was a Sharpei cross American bulldog. I mean, what a mix. The dog had some relationship issues with the owner, not in a terrible way, but there was some inconsistencies in the way that the dog was behaving. And at home, the dog had growled at the father. There were some aggression issues there. So when the dog came in to see me, the dog wasn't actively trying to pursue me. He wasn't coming over trying to be aggressive. He was curious about me. I said to the person at the time, look, let him off lead. And she said, are you sure? And I said, yep, absolutely. Let him off lead. So the dog was off lead. He was walking around. She was explaining to me. And the reason I said this is because the entire part of the conversation was, when people try and engage with my dog, when people try and touch my dog, he shows aggression towards them. She asked me again, she said, are you sure it's okay for him to come off lead? And I said, yeah, because I'm not going to touch your dog. And she goes, okay. And I said, that's the trigger. That's the point of contention between your dog and the relationship with other people. So the dog came off lead. He walked over towards me and she said, aren't you scared? And I said, no, because I'm not going to reach out. I'm not going to do what he believes I'm going to do, which is reach out and touch him. I said, you and I are going to have a conversation. He walked over towards me. He whale-eyed me a little bit. He walked away, tucked his tail between his leg. He wasn't excited about the entire introduction whatsoever. But at no time did the dog show aggression towards me. We had an hour together. The first half an hour, the dog was walking around while the owner and I were talking about what needs to happen, what needs to change, and why I believe that the dog had become the way it had to become. The second part of it was we got up and walked around. We were inside the shed. I locked the door. Nobody could walk in unexpectedly. We weren't going to change the parameters of how this dog was going to be introduced to anybody else. Like nothing bad was going to happen in this session. So while that happened, we were talking and I developed an understanding of what the dog's likes and dislikes were in life. And we found out he likes balls and he likes tugs and he likes doing those sort of things with the owner. So we brought a box of them out and started tossing a few around on the floor. And sure enough, the dog changed. His entire mind frame changed. I said to the owner of the dog, start playing with him. Do some fun stuff with him. She picked up a ball and she bounced it around and the dog started becoming aroused. And then he engaged. He wanted to play with the ball and he wanted to play tug and keeping off with her, which was great. And then I said to her, when you get the opportunity, pick the ball up and throw it to me. So she picked the ball up. The dog come running over completely. I mean, we've seen this before. I'm not talking about you and I. I'm talking to people out there in the podcast land. But completely different mind frame from the dog, completely different facial structure. The eyes softened, the ears relaxed, the dog's body posture, the tail unsucked between his legs. I know people have seen this type of thing before. Importantly, the mind frame change of the dog. That's the point I'm trying to get to through engaging in play. So we started playing a little bit of keepings off. The dog ran over towards me. Again, I didn't touch the dog. I didn't advance towards the dog. In fact, I moved away from him while I was bouncing the ball. He became excited. His arousal levels were increasing. I threw it towards the owner. I said, you reward the dog, like you reward him. And I said, I'll eventually bounce it towards him, but I want him to play with you. So he came over. The ball was one of those balls on a string. She came over, grabbed the ball, and I said, keep it going, keep it going. You know, move him around. The dog was going out of his mind with excitement. He absolutely changed his whole paradigm. Everything that we wanted to develop with this dog came true. Subsequently, that's how we ended the session. Play for different avenues of different procedures are exceptionally important. Again, it's like that helmet raiser comment that he made earlier on. We've been doing practices like that for years. But never really thinking about the importance of I really need to impart this on my students. I really need to make sure that I'm layering this to an understanding of why we're doing it and how we're doing it. I guess I've always known the importance of play. I've always known when I'm playing with my own dogs how important that is and how much of an impact that has between the relationship between me and the dog. And I've told owners to do similar things before, but I've never really thought about it in a breakdown until I started hearing Jay talk about it. And I thought, yeah, that's a really salient way of putting things that I've never really gone into a large amount of depth about how important it actually is and the developmental procedures of it and how it relieves a lot of the tensions of all of the demands and asks that we're going to start layering in on top of the dog, how important this next step is so we can finish with the dog anticipating that everything is going to improve in my life. My life is going to get so much better if I start doing this. And I'm already making connections and parallels between the conversation that we had before as well, is that this is a significant part of the developmental and the brain structure of how a dog understands how the relationship between you and life actually starts to improve its understanding and standing of the world, I guess I'm trying to say.
Yeah, good points. On her question, it says, how do you like to teach and build functional toy play? And I think the basis of that, I think, is possession, right? So in terms of how to build it, I think you have to have a dog that wants the thing. Like,
100%.
That's what I think sometimes. Yeah. So I think sometimes we forget that when we're playing tug with a dog, like we think of it often, I think, you know, words are really important, right? And sometimes we lose sight of the fact that you're playing tug as in tug of war, right? As in someone's trying to win possession of the item. Because I think that sometimes because we play tug with tugs and we call this a tug toy, right? We often sometimes, I think sometimes people lose track of the idea of like, they call it a tug and I'm playing tug because I'm holding this thing and I want the dog to also hold it, right? Mm. And they lose sight of the fact that, no, you're actually trying to take it from the dog. Like that's the whole point of the game here. And in order to be able to play a game effectively where you're trying to take it and the dog is trying to keep it, and it's a game of keep away in a sense and then possession in a sense, the dog has to want it, right? Mm. So I think that's step one, no matter what, no matter whether the dog is a pet dog or a working dog, whatever, there has to be a level of wanting it. And how you're going to build that is probably through prey, could be through a little bit of suspicion. Like there's lots of different things that you can tap into getting a dog to want something. But then in those early phases of playing with a dog, doesn't matter what kind of dog it is that your threshold of how hard you're going to try and take it from the dog has to simmer around the same level of how much the dog wants to keep it. Because we do this all the time. You know, you might get, say, like even you get really high drive border collies. I've had plenty come in here recently that, you know, really high drive dogs, but their possession just isn't really there, right? Like they want to chase stuff. They want to stalk it, but actually holding it in their mouth is not super important to them. And if tug is the, you know, because it is a really handy way to reinforce the dog, those sorts of dogs take a bit of convincing to even hold it. And so they'll strike it for sure. But then they're like, well, that was the fun part. Like I've stalked, I've chased, I've done the strike. Like that's really as far as I'm interested in going into this. And if you try and you know, reef it out of their mouth at that point, they're just like, oh, well, you can have it. Like, I don't want it that badly. And I quite like it when you are able to take it from me because then I get to chase it and strike it again. Right. So I think big part of remembering is that in those early phases with the dog, is that the gameplay of tug need to manage or approximate how much you're getting from the dog is how much you can give to the dog. And so sometimes that just looks like giving the tug a little heartbeat, just keeping it alive enough that the dog doesn't want to let go of it. And then building that up to as hard as you can, trying to really take it from the dog and lifting the dog by the tug and swinging it around and employing strategies in order to distract the dog off of it so that you can win it. And all those sorts of things is really important along the way. The next part of the question is, how do you use toy play to create work ethics in your dogs? And is it different for pet dog versus working a sport dog? It really isn't. I think in order to develop that work ethic is that it's two parts. the harder the dog will work in the gameplay, the harder he'll work to actually maintain possession of the tug or win it from you, or, you know, get to the point where he gets to parade and attempt to consume, like all that kind of stuff. The intensity with which a dog will do that is the same intensity with which it will perform work that will earn that. And I think that's the cornerstone of everything. Mm. It really is, like, that's lesson 1.1 in dog training. And it's certainly in the new course that I just put out, like that is what the lesson is called, is you have to keep in mind that a dog will only do the work that we're going to ask of it. It'll only do the healing, the downing, the recalling, whatever it is. It's only going to do that with the speed, power, intensity, you know, insert whatever buzzword you want there, right? It's only going to do that with the same level of arousal that it wants the reinforcer, because it's doing it in order to earn the reinforcer. It's not necessarily doing it for the love of the thing yet. It depends on how you teach it. Now, in order to have the dog do it as part of its reinforcer, where we always say that, you know, like you hear the catch cry of like, the dog should love the work should be the reinforcer. That's a really easy thing to say. That's a different thing altogether to teach. And that involves a really thoughtful and detailed understanding of the predatory chase sequence and trying to create the idea where the dog is in the behaviors. It is in the stalk of the chase sequence. It is thinking of itself as being reinforced while it has the opportunity to do the behaviors. The act of doing the thing is blurred with the act of taking the reinforcer. And sometimes if we can pull that off, which is not always possible depending on the type of dog and how you've taught the thing, but if you can pull it off that the dog sees doing the work as a part of the reinforcement cycle, then you're home and hose. The dog never doesn't want to do it. It always, like, provided that the dog is healthy and well and wants the reinforcer, it'll do the work. But the final thing where she asks here, Carrie Jo asks, is it different for pet dogs versus working or sport dogs? I would say no. For me, the way that I develop any sort of toy play is relevant to the drives of the dogs.
Yep.
And so if you come to me and you've got an off-tap Mallee and you say, this is my pet dog, I'm like, well, fucking your pet dog is going to be a sport/working dog you just don't compete with because you have no choice. This is the level of drives that you have, and this is how we're going to satiate those. And so if someone comes to me and they've got, this is just my pet dog, I don't want to play tug, you know, I don't need any crazy amount of arousal. It's like, no, you have the amount of arousal you have here, my friend. This is the dog you have. We're going to have to meet the dog at that level, or else you're going to have a very unhappy, unsatiated, probably problematic dog. So for
that's
me,
gonna direct it really, elsewhere.
Yeah, that energy's going somewhere.
Yep.
It could be into this tug twice a day for 10 minutes, or it can be into your couch when you're not looking.
Yep.
Right? Like, you take the choice. Which one do you want it to be? So that for me is how I distinguish those things. I don't think, like, I don't really look at the way I'm going to play with a dog beyond, the only differences would be if it was a working dog and I'm teaching someone to play tug with it, like there's certain things that I want to keep, I'm going to put more value into, like keeping the grip intact and stuff like that. You can pretty easily, depending on the type of tug that you're using with the dog, you can really piss off your decoy. If somebody's putting a lot of work into developing that dog forward for you and having that dog bite with its back teeth in a particular way and move in a particular way when it's biting, and then you're letting it front mouth rattle on a tug and letting it pull that tug out of your hands, if your decoy catches you doing that, you're gonna have a conversation, because you're essentially making it to the point where he's trying to fill a bucket with a hole in it. That's the only reason there would be any difference. If there were a specific gripping technique that I need from a working dog, then that's the only reason why there would be any specific tug games or techniques that I would use separate to a pet dog.
I think I made that point before, is when you're escalating towards a goal of eventually getting your dog onto working for a suit, that you have to transition your dog through a process to understand, like, this is evolutionary, like I'm staging up. But I totally agree with you. Play is play, really. And you want to make sure that you understand what engagement is, you understand what appropriate selection of reinforcers are. Like, if none of that makes sense to you and you don't know what you're doing, then go and see a trainer who actually knows how to do that, like start you off on the right path. There's been a myriad of experiences I've had firsthand with working with people who just inappropriately select reinforcement for their dog, whether that be a type of food that they want to use or even a toy that they want to use. And I know I've told this story before, but nonetheless, it warrants a quick recap on. Years ago, when I was still working for ADT in Melbourne, we used to have a group that we would teach advanced complex skills to. So it was the upgrade to advanced obedience. So once you've done advanced obedience, you could then come into this group and you could start working on teaching a dog's complex skills. So it was the reward for finishing advanced obedience for the handlers. So in this group, we had a lot of highly polished dogs. They were great at their obedience skills, and also they were terrific dogs. Like, they had high level of drive. Owners really knew how to connect with their dogs. They also knew how to play with their dogs. However, there was one lady in the group that was consistently not going anywhere with her dog. Her and I had a conversation. She had selected like a teddy or something like that. It was a toy that she wanted to use for her dog's reinforcement. So when she used to produce this in front of the dog, you could see the dog taking it. It didn't look like reinforcement. It actually looked like a form of punishment. Like, the dog would take it.
Lackluster.
Yeah, that's a good word. It had plenty of lackluster when it went to receive this. I'd spoken to her about it before, and she said, "Oh, no, 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 this works. Trust me, this works. It's just the dog is distracted when it's here." And I said, "Yeah, that's the conversation I'm trying to have with you. Like, we need to talk about this." But no, it was falling on deaf ears, and I just got hands in the air, like hands in my face, like, "Stop, I don't want to have this conversation." So this didn't really become anything about reinforcement, reward, and play. This came more about, this is something that I've emotionally selected for the dog, and I want the dog to have this toy. It came to a head one day because the owner said to me, "I'm sick of not going anywhere. I'm sick of this not working. Like, why isn't this working?" And I said, "For the last month, I've been trying to have this conversation with you delicately. Like, I've been trying to explain to you, your dog is not into your reinforcer. It doesn't want it." All I got was resistance. I simply got, "No, this works. You don't understand. Like, when I play with this at home, my dog engages." I said, "I get it and I understand." And I said, "Being a fly on the wall, I would suggest that that's all your dog's got at home, and that's the only thing that your dog's got to look forward to. So yeah, I'm sure that there is some form of engagement that I haven't even seen yet. But I'm telling you, when the dog comes down here, the arousal and the interest is not into what you're providing. It's what the other two people are using with their dogs, like cheap $3 squeaky things that the dog wants to engage in." And I said, "How do I know that?" And I said, "Because your dog can't fucking take its eyes off it." And I said, "That's why the dog is completely distracted. That's why nothing is happening down here." And I said, "There's no point in even introducing consequences and trying to get your dog back onto what you're providing." And I said, "Because that completely defies the whole purpose of why we're actually here." Now, this went into a major meltdown where the client basically said, "I don't want to be here anymore. I'm finished. I'm done." Had a hissy fit, walked off the field. And I'm sitting there with a bunch of people behind me involved in a, well, I wouldn't call it an argument, but involved in a conversation, a non-productive conversation when it's supposed to be a training session. Long story short, the people in the group said, "Such and such wants to come back." I won't use their name because I'm sure they listen to the show. "Such and such wants to come back. Can they come back?" And I said, "Of course they can come back. I never kicked them out. Like, it was their choice to walk out. I never said the words to them, 'You have to leave,' or 'You have to finish up here.' What I said to them is, 'Your dog is not engaging in what it should be engaging in. I can help improve this situation. I can make it so much better for the dog. I can start to see elevation in the dog's training practices, like all of your dogs are doing.' I said, 'Every time you're coming here, you know, between 5 and 10%, I can see an improvement in your dog's behavior. Like, your dogs are actually learning the skills that we're aiming for. Incrementally, we're ratcheting up. This dog is not. It's holding ground. It's, in fact, it's starting to decrease in the behaviors we wanted to do or we're trying to shape, because the dog doesn't understand. It has nothing to yearn for, nothing to hope for when it's here anymore." Finally, long story short, owner came back. We switched out the reinforcer. Hey presto, the improvement in behavior started to go through the roof. The dog started to level up and started to match what the other dogs were doing. The owner was upset about lots of emotions, lots of big feels. But as I said to them, I said, "This is not a I told you so game. This is simply, I'm trying to do what's best for your dog. Your dog has a selection criteria and what it wants to use. There's no point on using something that you believe is reinforcement, which has actually become punishment to the dog. This is now a form of punishment that you're trying to force this into your dog's mouth. You believed in your body, mind, and soul that this was a love gift, something that you had selected for the dog, but it actually wasn't. It was nothing of that." I can't tell you how many times I've seen that happen. And I would regretfully say I've done the same thing myself in the past. I've done those sort of things with animals that I've been training before, where I've been insisted I've had something, a form of food, a silly toy or something like that, where I thought, "This will get me over the hump. This will get me over the hurdle. This will be enough." So sometimes I think even professional trainers, when they're rushed or when they're not thinking about things and when they haven't put any leverage into developing a training plan with a dog that really needs more than that, you can actually find that what you've selected is
not only is it not going to work well, but it's highly inappropriate for the training session. It's almost offensive that you become that complacent and that lazy to not give it any thought and not develop the architecture of a system where it's going to be beneficial for both you, the handler, and the dog.
I think that's a massive part of dog training that we sometimes don't put enough weight into is understanding arousal and knowing, like, you want to control the level of arousal of your dog to the level that serves you, right? And so that might not be what's convenient for you at the time. It has to be what serves you. So if at home you train with a particular toy or item, whatever it is, you've got a reinforcer that brings the dog to a particular level of arousal and that is what serves you there, great, like, cool, use it. But if when you go somewhere else, if that toy has a cap, like the way that you're able to use it, the way that the dog thinks of that thing, if that hits a limit, then something else is above that and you don't want to train in that higher state of arousal, well, you kind of don't have a choice. You have to meet it because for sure you can crush the doggy out of not wanting that other thing, but then there's a huge amount of risk of you not wanting the thing that you then had, right? Like, because you're, if you're just going to bring a arousal level down, there's a lot more risk in doing that. So I think sometimes we see that from people who are like, yeah, but if I use this, then, you know, it's one of the ones I often, like, people say, oh, like, I've had a couple of people at seminars that say, I can't train with food because the dog will bite my hands. And it's, oh, it gets the dog too crazy for the food. The dog's like crazy high food drive. And I'm like, yeah, but it's what you need in order to get this behavior right. So we need to work on that.
Yeah, we need to teach the dog how to take the food without.
We don't, like, we can't just go, hey, the dog bites my hands, I can't train food. Like, oh, we've got to show it, like, open and close hand lures and stuff like that, and deliver in different ways. Because if the dog comes into a level of arousal that you don't enjoy or find easy to train the dog at, then you've got to put in the work to be able to do that. Because if that's the level of arousal of the competing motivators, then your motivator has to match or be above that in order to be the motivator. You're not going to convince a dog to do something for something it doesn't want unless it's in avoidance of something it wants to avoid.
Mm. That's a very good point. I appreciate everything you just said there. I recall at a stage in training when I was more heavily involved in training where another trainer told the handler that was working with me that it was foolish that I told the handler of the dog the toy that it was using at home, which was serving no functional purpose when the dog was out in public, I said, switch it out. And then the other trainer intervened in that and said, you don't want your dog starting to become toy selective and starting to have like a complete range of toys. And I said, let's not be silly about this. I didn't say, let's just start littering the field with every form of toy there was. What I said to you was the form and function, primarily along the lines of what you were just saying, like, this is working at home, but I said, what we need to do is transpose something that's working on the field because it's not having the desired amount of arousal. Like, it's not catching the dog's eye. The dog is not interested in it in lay terms. What we need to do is we need to find something that the dog is actually interested in out here because everything else is competing in the dog's mind and that doesn't bring it on. That's not powerful enough for the dog to understand, like, oh, I could get this. Because the dog's saying, well, fuck that. I don't need it. It's such a low level. The world has become so interesting to me. But this toy actually does that. It serves that functional purpose. When the dog sees that, it thinks, hang on a second. Yeah, the world is interesting and there's a lot of things going on. But that thing you've got, I really want that. I have a real interest in that right now. Like I said before, let's not get silly about these conversations. I have said it before, know thy dog. And if your dog has an interest in something and you can use it to assist your dog in learning and bring on those levels of control and help develop an understanding that, yeah, there's some pretty exciting stimuli in the world, but this is available to you. And if you give me short bursts of attention, you can have access to it. And then when your attention starts increasing, you can have more access to it. And we can play games with this and we can do all sorts of things like this. Again, not teaching people to suck eggs. We've had these conversations along the lines. It's just knowing, as you said before, Pat, it's knowing how to control levels of arousal. It knows what, how to bring on arousal levels. It's also about knowing about how to not overly arouse your dog in situations where you don't want high levels of arousal.
Yeah.
And that ultimately comes into know what arousal looks like and know how to use it for your purpose and the dog's purpose, like how to bring in better levels of control and understanding of what happens at home versus what happens in outdoors versus what happens in different locations, utilize it, but also know how to selectively cap it so it can be used for good and not for evil.
For sure. I think there's layers to this stuff. I think sometimes the headline is always don't let your dog develop a toy preference. And if you pull out the toy, and you know, I've said this, right? If I pull out the toy and the dog's like, no, I'm not interested. I'm like, well, this is all you're getting, mate. You can't tell me you're not interested. There's layers to the interest. But if the game is with me and this toy is just the game that we're playing. And I think that's the mindset that you have to sort of have, in that I equate it to playing board games, right? So me and you can play chess. Maybe I'm really into chess. I enjoy playing chess. I really want a strategy and I want to beat you and I'm into it, right? But then if you say, okay, now let's play Scrabble, I'll play because I enjoy playing with you, right? I'm into it, but I'm not that into playing Scrabble. I'm going to do it and I'll do it to the best of my ability, but that's a pretty low ability because I'm just not that into it. And so I think the same happens with the toys. And you got to think about that. Again, like, I keep saying I've got this video on that. I need to hurry up and finish this course so I can actually sell it. But I have a whole section where I'll get Remy. Jazz filmed it for me at a park, right? And so we're in this park, there's nothing around, and I pull out just because I think one of the things you got to know with your own dog, when you say know thy dog, is you got to know how those different reinforcers work in different levels of arousal so that you can take stock of the situation, know 100%. What you're going to teach, know the environment that you're in and go, okay, well, the reinforcer today is this. Because I want to cultivate this level of arousal, that's going to be what serves me. So in this one session, I take my dog from, you know, like he's into it, like, yeah, he's into the game. And I slowly cycle up all the way to he's off tap and I can barely manage him. And so I show that in the one session, there's no tools on the dogs, no collars, no nothing. I just get out the ball, just a tennis ball. And that for me with my Malinois, that's the easiest way for me to control his arousal, is because he likes just sort of catching it, but he immediately wants to give it back to me. So if I have to teach him something about how to do something, that's the way that I can get the maximum number of reps. If I'm not using food, I just use a tennis ball, or, you know, it doesn't have to be a tennis ball, but just a ball, a normal ball. Because he's not possessive of that. He doesn't really want to hang on to it himself. He wants to just give it back to me. And there's really no way for us to fight over it, because it's either in his mouth or it's in my hand. And it's very hard to blur those two things. So he's like, okay, I can think really clearly. Yes, I want that ball, but I'm going to be impulsive a little bit, but I want it, right? Like I want to earn it and I'll think nice and clearly. But then I can change that ball out and put it to a ball on a string. Now we got a whole different thing going, because now he'll start to, not only can I throw it and he chases it and he gets to bring it back to me, but now we can fight with it because I can hold the string.
Yeah.
And I can start asking for outs. Like, I don't even give an out command with a normal ball. I just put my hand out and he puts it into my hand. I don't have to tell him to let go of it. But now that there's a tug game involved, now there's some fight. So now there's like, okay, we're using more of the predatory chase sequence. So therefore the arousal is going to go up, right? So now I can, with that same ball that I could was just popping into the air that he strikes, because that's all he's doing is striking. Now I can pop that into the air and he can strike and we can fight. And then when he outs it, I can throw it. So now he gets to chase, right? So now, like, the more of the sequence that I can bring into it, the more aroused he gets. Then I get out the Frisbee. And because I use one of those chuck it Frisbees that I can play tug with, now I can introduce the stalk. Because I can throw the Frisbee and he has to watch it fly through the air in full anticipation. And then I can send him to get it. So he's stalking, he's chasing, he strikes it out of the air. He runs back to me. We fight with it. And then, you know, maybe I let him win the fight and he parades it. Boom, we've got almost the entire predatory chase sequence. So his arousal level comes way up. And then oddly enough, it kind of breaks the rules a little bit. But with my dog, if I get out the water Kong, because he's so mental for water, if I get out the water Kong, even if we're not near water, you know, the orange Kong with the really long handle, he sees that thing. Like, I can barely control him, right? Like, that is a proofing tool for me if ever there was one, because his arousal level just becomes to the point where he's very, very difficult to manage. And then all of that without asking for a single behavior, just showing him this is the toy, this is the one, right? And I can bring his arousal level all the way up and then I can cycle it all the way back down by showing him all the different things. Now I would never, typically I wouldn't ever do that in a session beyond just to demonstrate those different arousal levels. But I think that's what is the takeaway, is that you can control your dog's arousal level to the level that serves you. And that might not be the one that you want, but it's got to be the one that allows the dog to be like, hey, you have the thing that I want. And it relates back to what we're talking about at the start with that attention, intention, and attraction. Mm. Like if you don't have those things from your dog, if they're not pointed loosely towards you and the reinforcer, if they're pointed out towards the environment, you're not training your dog. Like you can't do that because now you're going to be fighting over, this is how you bring in a lot of conflict. And this is how people end up correcting their dog a ton. And you have many and various things that can go wrong is because you don't have the dog dialed in. So using the appropriate toy that dials the dog in is the ticket rather than just like bring the dog to the maximum or this is the one that I like to use. Therefore, it's the one the dog has to use with me. It's about knowing what's going to get the job done here. One of the things that I don't do much of it anymore, but I have from time to time is when I'm doing obedience around decoys, like a super stimulating thing for my dog, I sometimes will reward him with food in that moment, like just single pieces of kibble, just one single piece. And that really helps me bring my arousal level down. So like if my dog sees two decoys and he dials in on them and he thinks, yep, for sure, I'm here to do bite work. And then I go, good boy, and give him one single piece of kibble for having done something. He's like, okay, those decoys may as well have just disappeared. And now I'm working for this little piece of kibble. Like it's barely a reinforcer. It's just how I can say to him, hey, this is the level of arousal that I want you at. And this is what will serve us. So I control arousal via reinforcers and access to them.
Mm.
We've only got through two. But these are great. I enjoy these. I love just triggering the conversations. I like having the conversation with you, Glenn. And we'll find you're off overseas. This episode will come out and then you'll be in Vietnam judging
their
trial.
First PSA trial ever.
How exciting.
I know.
To me, I think that obviously it's got to be a fun trip for you. I couldn't get there. I was going to go decoy, but I just couldn't make it.
Mm.
Couldn't get the trip. But I'm super excited about that. Like just the idea that the growth in the region is now at the point where there isn't some expectation that you have to go back to, like Jerry doesn't have to go and judge that trial. You know what I mean? Mm. Like there's other judges in the region. And that to me is an indicator that we've done, you know, me, you, and many, many others in Australia have done a really good job of cultivating the sport here. And it's growing throughout the Asia Pacific region, meaning that there's more and more access, there's more and more people doing it, it's becoming more and more mainstay within the community. So I think it's fucking great. I'm super excited that you're going over to do that. And I hope everybody there kills it.
Mate, I couldn't have said it better. It's a complete honor and privilege to be asked to go over there. I've never been to Vietnam before. So that's ticking something off the bucket list because I did want to go over and check it out. I wanted to do it with Narelle, but I'm still excited nonetheless. And I'm going to get to go over there. Tenua's going to be there. Casey's going to be there. There's decoys from America. There's decoys from India coming over. It's going to be a great little catch up with everybody. And yeah, it's incredible. Like it's their very first trial. It's a privilege that I actually was asked to come over there and start them off on their official journey into hopefully getting a leg of a title at some point in time. That will be very exciting. At least some PDCs, that would be absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
I know that they've been putting in a lot of hard work over there. So let's report on this when I get back and I'll tell you all about it.
When you put it that way, right, as far as growth in the international regions for PSA, we're about to have a trial in Vietnam judged by an Australian judge.
Yep.
Bringing over the senior decoy is Adrian Ray. So bringing over a decoy from the US, other decoys coming from India.
Mm.
Your steward is going to be an American living in Australia. Yep. So like it's a true
multicultural event,
international region thing where a lot of people are coming together to make it happen, which is, it's super cool. I'm really glad that it's happening. I wish I could have been a part of it, but I'm happy for it to be happening without me nonetheless.
And the trial secretary is coming from Hong Kong.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Incredible.
All right. So, but we'll find time to get more episodes done. We've got a massive list of questions here that's going to keep us busy. What episode is this? This is
295.
Oh, Jesus. So we're still flapping in the breeze thinking about what we're going to do
for
300. For
300
I think
episodes.
At the minimum, maybe we should do video. I feel like we could just do, I don't know, something different, like different production.
Yep.
We should do something. Anyway, ideas, shoot them to us. You can do that in the group, do it publicly, do it privately, whatever you want. Ideas for the 300th episode. We want to do something special. It's a big milestone for us. It's over 5 years and 300 episodes doing this. I've got a funny story. I should tell it at a different time, but like I caught up with a bunch of my school friends recently, you know, who I don't see that often. I see them once every 6-12 months, something like that. It'll be someone's birthday that I can get to. A lot of those guys, they still work together. Most of them are lawyers and stuff. So they sort of are in the same sort of space as each other because they do stuff on weekends and I often work. I can't get there. So it's rare that I get there, but I did recently. And these are guys that really know me as an army guy, right? Because the times, like, they know me from school. They know what I was like at school. And they know me for my first 10 years out of school when I'd see them more frequently. But all they know of me is the Special Forces army guy. They follow me on Instagram, you know, like you forget that there's normal people from your normal life that aren't interested in dog training. Cause like all my Instagram is just like, hey, I'm a dog trainer, buy my stuff. Here's what I do, right? Like it's all business page.
Yep.
But these guys still follow it. And one of them was like, what the fuck do you do for a job? I was like, I don't know, mate. He goes, I'm seeing videos of you getting bit by dogs and what the fuck do you actually do? I was like, yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. I'm not really sure how to answer that. But anyway, I forget where I was going with that. I'm going to do the wrap up. That's it for another episode, Canon Paradigm. As always, if you like what you hear, like, rate, share, subscribe, do that through whatever subscription service you download us from.
Don't forget to do that. Like, don't just listen to this and just think, oh, it's just the wrap up. I don't have to do that. Like, legit, if you can, it helps us. You have no idea how much it helps us if you like us, rate us, share us. All of those things will actually help us.
It is because what you see now, like in the podcast space, because we don't do video, we don't have the clips. You know, there's no clips of us just pretending that we're on a podcast. Those reels of people talking into microphones, looking at nothing. We don't do that. And so we do need your help to continue to grow the show. And if you think there's value in it, then that's all you need to say. Just put a rating and say, hey, there's value in this. You could learn something, right? Yeah. That's all you need. And that tells the algorithm to push it to other people. And when people search dog training podcast, will remain something that comes up instead of in the flooded space of getting drowned out by other stuff.
Even if you just send a message to one of your mates just saying, hey, listen to these two warble on.
These two dickheads. Two dickheads have been waffling for 5 years and 300 episodes. Oh, that's where I was going with it. That's where I was going with my school friends. So then one of them says like, how come I don't see any, like you've got this podcast, I don't see any clips of it. I was like, we're old school, man. We're old school podcasts since before when podcasts were really just a thing you listened to in your car and you didn't have to film it. We're OG podcasters, 5 years and 300 episodes.
But how many podcasts do you watch of people actually in a room together? Like, do you invest a lot of time into that? Because I lose interest in watching people talking.
Yeah. So I rarely ever watch the actual podcast.
Yes.
But I listen through YouTube a lot because, to be honest, like I don't use my podcast app very much anymore. Since I got... A few years ago, you know, YouTube's always trying to convince you to get a YouTube premium subscription. And I always was like, why would I pay for this? Fuck off, YouTube. I'm not paying you. It's the best. Of all my subscription services, if I had to get rid of all of them, YouTube would be the last one to go.
Okay.
Because it's the best. And so I do listen to a lot of podcasts through YouTube.
Right.
And but I don't watch them. Like I just have listened through the YouTube app.
Cool. Okay. That answers that question.
We need a person. We need a person that does that for us. We need to get 300 episodes onto YouTube somehow.
Yeah, we do. Anyway, if anyone wants to.
If anybody's that person.
Yeah, let us know.
So you've liked, rated, supported. Now it's time to jump into Patreon. In Patreon, there's new stuff all the time going forward. There's this giant backlog of information. I do a live stream. I owe them a live stream. I went to do that again the other day, but then just... My brain fog just wasn't there to do it. I was so sick. I had to postpone a live stream. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to catch that up. There's one guy. There's another one that I've set the date for. You guys will get the notification about that. So there's live stream every month, as well as a bunch of other different stuff that we just put into Patreon whenever we feel like
Still got to do the PSA one. Still got to do it. Still got to do it. Yep.
I'm going to do it when Sean and Janet are here.
Yep.
Another way to support the show is to buy cool merch. You could jump into Teespring, or Spring, they call it now, and get yourself some cool merch from us in there. You get a giant tapestry or a hoodie or a t-shirt. It says Cool Story, Show Me Your Dog. They're pretty popular. Mm. Who would have thought that Katrina's little stick figure would be our like most...
The one that tapped it over everything else. We have professional artists who've spent hours and hours and hours developing art, and then Katrina does like a pub napkin with a little stick figure of a dog.
It's because it's on brand. That's why it's so, you know, like it fits our brand so well.
Yep.
Anyway, so buy one of those. If you want to get in touch with us, best way to do that is to jump into the Facebook discussion groups. About 10,000 people in there, all discussing dog stuff, having a good time, being nice to each other. Jump in there and check that out. Or if you want to shoot us an email, we are info@thecanineparadigm.com. Love you. Goodbye.